Hello, and welcome to the Development Debrief with Catherine Van Zickel, the stories-based podcast that interviews professionals, donors, and thought leaders in the field of fundraising.
BWF is proud to once again sponsor the Development Debrief podcast by Catherine Van Zickel. This season's theme centers around two core pillars of BWF, innovation and impact. With an exciting and impressive lineup ahead, we can't wait to hear what's happening in the industry and enjoy supporting changemakers committed to advancing philanthropy and finding the edge of possibility. One of BWF's core tenets is discovery. BWF empowers and revolutionizes philanthropic endeavors through data-driven, innovative solutions tailored to your organization. BWF serves large and medium-sized nonprofits in the areas of campaign management, high net worth fundraising, organizational consulting, data science, marketing, strategic communications, and technology. Clients include universities, health systems, arts and culture organizations, faith-based organizations, and NGOs throughout North America, Europe, Australia, and the Pacific Rim. As a truly comprehensive fundraising consulting firm, BWF has a team of consultants with an extensive background and experience in every facet of philanthropy. Visit BWF.com to learn more.
Welcome back to the Development Debrief and happy 2022. We've been off for 4 weeks planning this new season just for you around innovation and impact. If you haven't already, please check us out on Instagram at DevDebrief to follow along as the season unfolds. This is the first time we've really focused on a theme, and I'm excited to hear what you think as we go through the next 8 weeks. For our first episode, I have the absolute pleasure of speaking with Sue Cunningham, the CEO of CASE. Sue's long relationship with CASE, as well as her international experience, really sets her apart as a leader and a visionary. We talk about her career to date and then drill into CASE's most recent strategic plan. Sue tells us how she facilitates joining the dots globally. I love that term. She expresses pride in her staff, and she talks to us about the 6 key areas CASE will be focusing on as they recalibrate the organization into the next 5 years. Sue Cunningham is president and CEO of the Council for Advancement and Support of Education, CASE, which supports more than 3,600 schools, colleges, and universities worldwide in developing their alumni relations, communications, fundraising, and marketing operations in order to advance their institutions. As CASE president and CEO, she provides strategic and operational leadership for one of the largest associations of education-related institutions in the world, with members in more than 80 countries. She became president of CASE in March 2015. Prior to CASE, she served as vice principal for advancement at the University of Melbourne and as the director of development for the University of Oxford. She served as director of development at Christ Church, Oxford, and as director of external relations for St. Andrews University. She's an honorary fellow of the Melbourne Graduate School of Education and a fellow of the Royal Society of Arts, a recipient of the CASE Europe Distinguished Service Award, and a CASE Crystal Apple Award recipient. We'll talk more about what that is later. She holds a master's degree from Oxford University and a bachelor's degree in performing arts from Middlesex University. Now let's get started. Sue, thank you so much for being here.
Well, it's fun to be here, Catherine. Thank you for the invitation.
I've wanted to have you on for a while, and it seems like now's the perfect time. We have a really exciting topic today, and I know our listeners are going to be really excited to hear from you.
Well, thank you. And I'm joining a very auspicious list of people that you've interviewed, so I'm looking forward to the conversation.
I'd like to start with talking about your career to get some context on you, Sue, as the CEO of CASE. And then I want to talk about some work that you're doing with the organization and ways that you're innovating for CASE going into 2022 and beyond. How does that sound?
That sounds good. Sure.
Great. So let's start at the beginning of your arrival at CASE. I know that you were a vice president before arriving, and you had had a full, robust career. What brought you to CASE?
Well, if I wind back the clock to, so I started at CASE in March 2015. So it'll be 7 years next spring, which is unimaginable.
Wow.
But if I wind back the clock to the origins of my relationship with CASE, it's back in the late 1990s, because I'm very, very old. And I had been working before that in theatre and in museums and galleries. And I moved gradually from stage management to arts administration to discovering this thing called fundraising, initially in a photographic art gallery and then setting up fundraising for a set of museums in Wales in the UK. And so I found myself in the late 90s in my first role in a university at the University of St Andrews as Deputy Director of External Relations. And then my boss left. So within months, I became the director. And I felt very vulnerable in that I really didn't know a whole lot about educational advancement. And someone very early on introduced me to CASE. And I found myself at my first CASE conference months into my new job. And that was the beginning of CASE being my beacon and my torch for learning and for connecting with others across the profession, building a community that became a global community and one that I then became, as CASE does so well, very involved as a volunteer in different ways, from setting up the graduate trainee program in Europe to setting up the Spring Institute, which is very much like the summer institutes here. So I just, as happens, I got very drawn in. And fast forward to leaving St Andrews, going to the University of Oxford, then from the University of Oxford to the University of Melbourne. And when this position came up, and I'd been doing a lot of thinking about leadership, and one of the things I felt strongly about was to lead an organization, you have to care deeply about it. And I actually couldn't think of an organization I felt more deeply about than CASE. So I just feel incredibly fortunate to be in this role.
So it was a very natural journey that led you there. You were already there, but you just continued to deepen your relationship.
I think so. And in the way that CASE has evolved from originally being established in the US, and you can tell from my accent, I was born in California, to moving to Europe and then into Asia Pacific and ultimately Latin America. You know, I've been really fortunate to have the opportunity to engage with CASE, both in roles in the UK and in Australia, and now, of course, around the world and being based in the US. So it feels in some ways my life journey has reflected CASE's journey over nearly 50 years.
Interesting. And on top of that too, this idea of continuing to grow with an organization, that's very powerful.
It is. And again, as you know, as a very engaged member of this community, the community of CASE members, which is something like 92,000 people in schools and colleges and universities in 82 countries. I mean, it's just an incredible community, which is sharing, which is passionate about what we're doing, you know, getting up every morning to advance education because we know of the power it has in transforming lives and society. And one of the things that's excited me most about my time at CASE is really building a deep understanding and recognition that there's expertise in every corner of the globe in this work, and that there's opportunity therefore to learn. If you're based in San Francisco, there may be somebody in Singapore doing really interesting stuff in marketing and communications. Or if you're based in Bristol in the UK, there may be someone in Birmingham, Alabama, who's doing something really interesting from a philanthropic perspective. So there isn't another organization that joins those dots globally. And I think building on those opportunities for connection and learning is a powerful and important thing to be doing.
And it's interesting you say that, because that was one of the reasons I wanted to start this podcast, is I just firmly believe we can all learn from one another.
I think that's one of the really remarkable moments in our journey about 4 years ago, when we had CASE's commissions, which are sort of our think tanks. And they come together twice a year with representatives from around the world. And the Alumni Relations Commission was thinking about establishing standards for alumni engagement. And on this journey, a group of people were invited to join the commission, which had majority US, but not completely US members at that time. A group from the UK who'd been working on this concept, and they came and presented to the Alumni Relations Commission. And the sense of, wow, you've got so much further with this than we have as a profession in the US, arguably because US schools and colleges and universities, there's a lot more baggage in the way that There's decades of alumni engagement experience, but just, and what has come to pass, and there was a great group of volunteers, as is so often the case with CASE, who then worked with us to develop these alumni engagement metrics, which we're now entering the third year of rollout. But just, that's a beautiful illustration of that. People developing something on one continent, sharing it with people on another continent, and working together to refine something for the profession writ large.
Yes. So let's go back to 2015 when you started.
Of course, you already respected and loved the institution of CASE, but what are you most proud of that you've changed since then within the organization?
Well, I think the first thing I'd say is that as I, you know, not only am I deeply honored to work with volunteers and members around the world, but we just have an incredible group of staff based here in the US, based in London, in the UK, in Singapore, and Perth in Australia, and in Mexico City. So I think the thing I'm proudest of is the people and the extent to which they have helped drive the organization forward and just their incredible commitment. And again, when I arrived, we had four pretty separate offices with people connecting with each other as appropriate, but sparingly. And now there's, and you know, in a way that our virtual world has really emphasized the opportunity here, but we've built a whole matrix structure around how the organization works. So people working, for example, in educational programs are part of the division around the world. And the acumen is being shared. We're seeing a repetitive theme here, but that sense of learning and ability. Also just really proud of the sense of ambition in the development of work that we've done. So early on when I arrived, one of the first things we did, in fact, my first board meeting was 5 days after I started, was we determined we were going to start working on a new strategic plan, which literally came to an end this summer. But the work to develop that first strategic plan whilst I was president and CEO involved something like 2,500 volunteers and staff. So it was a real opportunity for a deep dive about what CASE most effectively might do for its members, how we could be most strategically impactful. And for a new CEO, it was perfect. It was just an incredible learning journey and a listening tour. And so I feel really proud. And some of the outcomes of that work included completely revisiting our governance structure. So when we started that strategic plan, we had 11 fiduciary boards for the organization, which was confusing at best. Really dedicated people, but confusing. We worked again with the volunteers around every one of those tables and others besides to shift to the model that we launched in the summer of 2020, where we now have one fiduciary board and a series of regional councils and district cabinets. So that was a huge, huge undertaking. And another one was building out our AM Atlas portfolio of data and surveys and research. And a key jewel in that work during that strategic plan was the acquisition of the VSE. So some really ambitious.
And the VSE is?
The Voluntary Supportive Education Survey. So this is a 60-year-old survey which has... which historically was fueled by CASE's counting standards, but owned and run by a different organization. So CASE acquired it about 2 years ago, I want to say, as part of the strategic plan and really building out data and resources in that context, predominantly for 4-year and 2-year institutions.
Wow. You've talked about volunteers a couple of times. They're clearly at the bedrock of CASE, but so many of us are working with volunteers. You know, I'm starting to work with volunteers in my new role. And I think we would all love to hear how you inspire and retain your incredible volunteers, many of whom have been on this podcast.
In my mind, it comes down to what so much of our work comes down to, which is about relationships. And, you know, the power when I sit at one of our regional council meetings or at our board meeting and just see either virtually or in person, just the incredible acumen you have around that table and the preparedness of the people around that table to engage in building and developing CASE in different ways, which is, and obviously at a board level in terms of the overall governance and future of CASE. And my
quick
sense
question,
is, sure.
Quick question, are your board members all practitioners?
Some are university leaders or school heads of schools. And many are practitioners in advancement from marketing communications to fundraising. And we've also had people on the board who bring expertise, strategic expertise or sector expertise who don't necessarily derive from any of those sectors. But I think in essence, if I go back to the relationship piece, it's about volunteers having a deep understanding of the expectation of what they're there to do and that it's advancing the organization strategically. And at the same time that they're being recognized and stewarded in a way that they feel that what they're bringing adds value. I mean, the other end of the spectrum, and I think we've probably all been there at different times in our careers, is when you bring a group of volunteers together because it feels like a good idea. And then you're sitting around the table and people are really not clear on why they're there, and things can spin in any direction. So I think coming down to a deep understanding of why this is strategically important for the organization, that it is a positive and valuable experience for the volunteers. And I think the two are synonymous. If it's strategically important for the organization and you've got people around the table who can add value, it's a win-win for everybody. And there is a long and deep history that long precedes me of CASE being just incredibly thoughtful and genuine about how much volunteers are valued, and the level of stewardship, I think, is second to none, actually, that my colleagues have delivered over many, many moons.
And I know it means so much to people because I've heard them say with pride, you know, the different tours of duty that they've done with CASE. And a lot of people have mentioned being a Crystal Apple winner, which I always found so mysterious. Was that in place when you arrived? Tell us about the apple.
The Crystal Apple has been around for a really long time. And when anybody, you know, a big part, or not one of the major things that volunteers do for CASE, which again is really unique to CASE, is we have all of these amazing people who are in frighteningly busy jobs who volunteer to help conceive, develop, and then deliver educational programs of different sorts, from conferences to institutes to, and whenever any of these programs are delivered, and we run 70 or 80 of them every year around the world, and predominantly virtual in the last couple of years, but we're moving back to in-person with the first couple this month, actually. We always seek feedback from the audience. You know, we survey the participants and we grade how people have performed as a result of that feedback. So we're asking those people who feedback to score people. And in essence, people who get the highest scores for more than 10 programs become Crystal Apple winners. And it's not surprisingly, it's a growing number of people. I was very honored to receive mine. I think it was back in 2008, but it's a very special thing. And you're right. I know that when people receive them or have had them, there's just that sense of immense pride in what they've achieved. We need to move on to the whole Crystal Fruit Bowl, but we haven't got there yet.
Oh, that's great. CASE for many people, I'll speak for myself, but for many people is sort of the gold standard in our industry. It's something that a lot of people have done at the beginning of their careers, going to the Summer Institute at Dartmouth. They've found CASE somewhere along the path, but I do think there's a sense of tradition that because it's the standard, it's not changing. So I think hearing you talk about these evolutions is really powerful. And so I want to talk about how you're recalibrating the organization with your latest strategic plan. And one of the terms that really stood out to me was strategic partner and professional home. So maybe we can start there.
Sure. So as you say, the board only a matter of weeks ago, so this goes live in the beginning of January, approved our next strategic plan, which will run from 5 years from the new year. And at the heart of it, and it's amidst the pandemic, like so many institutions did, we both navigated the complexities of the pandemic, which for a predominantly in-person program organization was interesting. And people did an amazing job and switched to virtual programs to great effect, actually. And again, staff and volunteers working together to do that. But the other part of what we were really focusing on during the last 20 months or so was really thinking about how we could be most strategically effective to the success of education worldwide for the next 50 years of CASE. And so we developed this new strategic plan, which is built upon what we're describing as our strategic intent, which is about defining the competencies and standards for the profession of advancement and leading their champion and championing them at their dissemination and application across the world's educational institutions. So it's taking some things that we've been building out for our strategic plan, like our global reporting standards, mm-hmm. and building new things like a career journey framework, which were built on the competency model from the last strategic plan, and really thinking about how we're impacting in a way that is strategic and profound upon the institutions for our members. And as a sort of illustration of when this is most successful, I emailed, as I do from time to time, one of our members who just announced a really significant gift as the sort of crowning piece of the campaign that they'd also just completed. And I emailed to congratulate him and his team on that success. And in his response, he acknowledged his team. And he also said, And Case has to also take credit for some of this success, because without what you do in terms of data, research, programs, and building of community, we wouldn't be in a position to do that. So I think our next strategic plan is really thinking very strategically about how can we move to a place where every institution that is a member of CASE sees us as that strategic partner. Mm-hmm. And I think some do right now and others maybe not so much. So it's an exciting and important journey over the next few years.
And this idea of a professional home, it's very comforting.
And thinking about the global reporting standards, which we published in March, which are really the standards for our profession, for the profession of integrated advancement. And again, when I think about integrated advancement and ways when Case talks about it, we're talking about all of those elements, marketing, communications, and alumni relations and fundraising and advancement services. There are often conversations that we all have of, you know, has the profession come of age? Is advancement truly a profession? And I think any profession that is a profession has standards that govern how we do what we do. And these standards have been in formation for 40 years. You know, the first edition was published 40 years ago, but these standards that we published this March are the first standards that are globally relevant. And the work of the staff and volunteers who created it was very focused on being really bold and unambiguous about it. So talking about things like donor influence, it includes things like the principles of practice for each of those professions. It includes the ethical standards. It includes thoughts around our pledge on inclusion and on zero tolerance. And it's really, I think there is lots of detail in this 309-page document about how and what you count, so that there is consistency and transparency in that. But also, to my mind, these are about upholding the reputation of the work that we do around the world. And, you know, some of the conversations I've had since they're published, you know, people have said, well, I can see our institutions following these standards, but there are some maybe not so much, to which my response is, you know, if you're a doctor, do you say where our standards are concerned? Yeah, I like this bit and this bit, but when it comes to saving lives, no, I'm not really going to follow that one. So I just think in terms of the growth of our profession and the real recognition of our profession, I think these standards are an integral part of that. And I'm really, really grateful to everyone who contributed to their production.
I think it's safe to say that people outside of our profession, some still find it quite mysterious. There are people who are maybe volunteers with their schools or parents. And so they know a little bit more now. I know I find that when I say I'm a fundraiser, I'm getting more of a head nod than maybe happened 20 years ago. But I think having these key areas for, you know, not only the world outside of fundraising, but for managers to use as benchmarks is so huge. So we have you to thank for that. What are the six key areas that we should all be focusing on and that you have named as the most important?
So I think in terms of the six key areas that are embedded in the new strategic plan, we're looking at a number of areas from the whole area of data and research, which the global reporting standards are obviously core to, the career journey framework. So thinking about how, you know, right now, if you're a member of CASE and you go to a summer institute, what's the next program you go to? Well, you know, go look at the website, as opposed to saying, well, actually, Catherine, now that you've done this program, let's look at your career journey and think about what the next steps might make most sense and which programs might make most sense aligned with the competencies that we've designed. These are the eight competencies that we think you need at every stage of your career and the different levels, different stages, whilst, of course, recognizing that every career isn't necessarily linear. So people go in different directions. Yeah. So there's the data and the research. There's the educational programs and that career journey framework. There's, of course, the really important area of looking at diversity, equity, and inclusion and belonging, and how CASE is working with our members to support a much deeper diversification of our profession, which we know is incredibly important and beneficial to the success of the work that we do. Member engagement is another critical area for us. And again, thinking about how we are those strategic partners of member institutions and how we build and grow our membership. You know, operating in every part of the world, there are some areas where advancement is very deeply developed and others less so. And at the same time, I think, you know, even where people assume in the US, every institution is really far advanced in this stuff, there are some where it's more nascent. And so recognizing that as well in that context. So there are a number of really key areas that are growing out of this plan as we develop and shape the future of the organization.
And you've talked about standards a couple of times, reporting. Aside from the obvious that we're all on the same page, you know, why is that such a priority for CASE and why is it so important?
I think, a fifth area that I didn't talk about was thought leadership. And I think the standards really fit both into our data and research work, but also into our thought leadership work. I interviewed a group of university leaders at a conference this summer, one of whom was from China, one who was from Hong Kong, one from Canada, and one from Australia. And we were talking about these standards, and the president from Australia said, these are reputationally critical. And if one educational institution anywhere in the world doesn't uphold these standards, it's sort of like a set of dominoes collapsing. So for example, if one institution is standing on the parapet saying, we've completed the campaign, we've succeeded in raising X, Y, and Z for this campaign, but the manner with which they've counted the campaign is not consistent with the standards, and another institution gets up somewhere else and says, we've done this with the campaign and we've raised X, Y, and Z, and that has been consistent with the standard, then the public is hearing information that is not consistent and that is, you know, makes us vulnerable, I think, to criticism about you're saying these things, but what solidity is it and where are the professional standards that back those up? So I think that's one really important piece. I think another important piece, if one thinks about the swirl of media that is not positive about our work, it often in this era relates to philanthropic engagement, or at times it's not philanthropic engagement, but it's described thus, like Varsity Blues, for example, which I don't think was about philanthropy at all. But so reputation relating to donor engagement and how we're relating to donors and what influence it's appropriate for donors to have and what influence it's inappropriate for donors to have. And again, I know many schools and colleges and universities have very clear internal guidelines on this. Mm-hmm. And the standards are really there to support the thinking around that and to provide definition around that. Because again, you know, in my mind, whenever I hear about a significant act of philanthropy or volunteerism, my heart is uplifted. And, you know, one would want that to be the sense societally. But I think the steps maintaining and adhering to these standards, I think, are really important to the reputation around our work and therefore to our institutions.
And forgive me, but is that where CASE 50 comes in? You know, are those 50 institutions that are agreed upon that they are following the standards and sort of have that gold seal?
So, and the CASE 50, which is a sort of misnomer because there are more than 50 institutions, but this is a group who come together, convened by CASE, who are the sort of top fundraising universities. And we have a parallel group called the Independent Schools Leadership Group who come together to exchange wisdom, to actually sponsor research for the broader profession. And many members of that group and out with that group were very involved in establishing and developing and sealing these standards. So yes, I would anticipate and hope that all of those CASE 50 institutions are very much aligned with what the reporting standards say. And in fact, one of its members was co-chairing the delivery of these standards. So I would very much hope that's true. I think the other thing I'd say in terms of that thought leadership strand and the reputation of our work is we're in the midst right now working with two other associations and with support from the Gates Foundation on really looking at how we can move the needle around perceived value of education. And in that context, particularly higher education, and looking at how we can work with marketing communications professionals and alumni engagement professionals to think about how we can create some umbrella messaging and communications for the sector writ large about the huge impact and value of higher education. And that, you know, that's not going to be like flicking a switch and things changing overnight, but it's a really important piece of work.
It is. And I too have friends outside of the sector who often ask me, why should I support my school? Why, you know, why do I need to go to a four-year in-person university? Of course, they all did, but questioning this culture in our society of why it's important. And I think we have to constantly be on top of that, of having good answers and continuing to uphold that as well.
And I think the engagement, and this has been more evident than ever, I think, through the pandemic, the engagement of stakeholders with the mission of the school or the college or the university is powerful and palpable. And as people, you know, with all of the external factors that we've been experiencing over the last 20 plus months, that I think people have thought more and more about what matters most to them and the mission yes. of what K through 12 schools are doing, the mission of what 2-year and 4-year institutions are doing. It's powerful. I mean, it's transforming lives in society and in some kinds saving lives. I mean, it's just, I remember years ago when I was working at the University of Oxford and having conversations with people doing our telephone fundraising. And they were saying, you know, some people I'm talking to are saying they're more interested in supporting charities that are putting roofs over people's heads or putting food in people's mouths. And we were talking about that and saying, you know, first of all, when one's talking to donors or potential donors, one should always be incredibly appreciative of what they're doing for any not-for-profit organization. But secondly, the institutions are often, educational institutions are often addressing challenges in today's society. I mean, particularly if one's thinking about access to education and the important work that's happening there, which is transformational, and also providing solutions for the future through research, through creating future leaders, through a whole array of things. So lifting people's aspirations and deeper understanding of the profound impact on lives. Again, I couldn't imagine doing our work and the kind of work we do with as much passion outside of education, because it's just such a powerful societal good.
And I mean, the saving lives, in some ways, it literally is true. You know, people joke, oh, this isn't heart surgery. It's not rocket science. Well, it is in some cases saving lives in a clear way.
And if you look at the way in which, you know, there are some institutions, obviously, that are involved in medical research at a higher education mm-hmm. level. And if you look at what many schools did through the pandemic, together mm-hmm. with higher educational institutions around the community work they were doing, around creating spaces for testing and for, you know, a whole raft of things, that level of community engagement and support. And again, in our value of higher education discussion work and the value of education work, that awareness societally about the huge impact that educational institutions have on their local community beyond necessarily just the students or the families, but much more deeply and broadly, is, I think, an area we have a lot more work to do in communicating and building understanding of.
Yes. So as people look to CASE in 2022, the first quarter, the second quarter, and on for the next several years, will it be looking different? Will it be feeling different? What should people know as we're getting this insider interview from you?
As with when you're building the foundations of anything, you know, when you look at a new building being built, and you see the boarding going up and the pictures of what it will look like, and then you don't see anything. As they're doing the foundations, you don't see a whole lot. And then suddenly it starts to. So I think part of leading this journey is about managing expectations. You know, we have a really ambitious and clear set of goals that we're seeking to achieve. And I look forward to people beginning to feel and see that shift around the diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging work. We're already rolling out things in the new year in terms of programs, but also in terms of offerings to work with our member institutions on their work within the institution in this space. So I think there'll be a number of sort of green shoots. And at the same time, I think more will become evident as we move deeper into the plan and into that 5-year period.
Well, I know I'm excited to see what comes out of this, and the debrief may be part of this as well in a small way. You know, it sounds like what you've done is taken what you already have, looked at your strengths and built them up, you know, again, to use your metaphor. And we are in our innovation season. So I want to end with a couple rapid fire questions. The first of which is, innovation is blank.
Doing inspiring things that are transformative.
And what is some advice you have about innovation after going through this process of putting together the plan that all of us should know? And then a way that we should be warned.
I think where innovation is concerned, you have to have space to fail, because there are many brilliant ideas and not all of them are going to pan out. Acknowledging that from the get-go and encouraging ideas, but also knowing when to stop, when things are not landing as you'd hope that they would land.
Is there anything else we should know about CASE going into 2022?
we've talked a lot about volunteerism and members of CASE and people being engaged in CASE at a volunteer level at any stage of your career is really encouraged. And there are myriad ways of doing that from, as you've heard me say, teaching on programs to being involved in advisory groups to sitting on district cabinets or councils or and so on. So there are many, many, many ways to be involved with CASE. And if there's a desire to build your community beyond your institution and to be doing work that advances our profession writ large globally, then really keen to hear from you. So please reach out if you're keen to explore doing that. And genuinely, the other thing I'd say is that the input, feedback, response to the work that is emerging or the work that we're doing already is always incredibly welcome. We are what we are because people have been open and supportive and honest and at times friendly critics, and I value all of that. So keep it coming and stay involved, and hope as the world, touch wood, opens up to see more of you in person next year.
Thank you. And I would love to end with my signature question, which is, Sue, what do you know for sure?
That tomorrow the sun will rise and the educational institutions have been, many of them have history that goes back decades and centuries, and many of them will have history that goes into the very, very, very far future and have weathered all sorts of storms. And it's just an incredibly important profession to be a part of. And I'm sure that I'm very grateful for it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Really an honor to be part of this.
CASE is truly a community of volunteers and leaders aiming to evolve and grow the profession. Sue said it herself, she'd love to hear from you and add to the growing community that is CASE. We'll be ending this season with a webinar on March 29th. Mark your calendars to join us and keep the conversation going. More on that soon, but in the meantime, please connect on social and have a great week.